in the limelight. Andrew M. Cuomo meditated on the lessons he had learned about generational and cultural shifts and argued his expressions of endearment could be dated, but certainly not malicious. He apologized for causing offense to the 11 women who had accused him of sexual harassment, even as he denied improper conduct. He was wistful as he described his affection for the state. The article you're about to hear has been written by Katie Gluck, the chief political correspondent of the New York Times. The piece is titled, In Resignation Speech, Cuomo Makes a Last Play to Preserve His Legacy. Andrew M. Cuomo meditated on the lessons he had learned about generational and cultural shifts and argued his expressions of endearment could be dated, but certainly not malicious. He apologized for causing offense to the 11 women who had accused him of sexual harassment, even as he denied improper conduct. He was wistful as he described his affection for the state. But as Andrew Cuomo resigned in disgrace on Tuesday, 10th of August, another message became clear. The governor, ever the tactician, was seeking redemption in the eyes of New Yorkers, straining to litigate and define his legacy, sometimes in defiance of reality, and to preserve his future standing amid the worst crisis of his career. Politically ostracized, facing criminal investigations and the prospect of impeachment, and with his family's legacy at stake, Mr. Cuomo's decision to resign completed one of the most stunning falls in modern American politics, marking the end of a political dynasty and the beginning of a chaotic and uncertain new chapter of governing in New York. But even on his way out, Andrew Cuomo, the iron-fisted pugilist who controlled the state capitol for more than a decade, made another political play. It was too late to persuade the people in power who had been moving swiftly through an impeachment investigation, but Andrew Cuomo sought a different audience. His appearance amounted to an overt pitch to New York voters, as he apparently moved to conjure up memories of his leadership during the early days of the pandemic and recalled the litany of progressive policies enacted under his administration. Many Democrats in New York and beyond had embraced Mr. Cuomo as their best foil against President Donald J. Trump, and the governor reached to remind New Yorkers of what they had once loved about him, even as his message elided or played down some of the key findings in an exhaustive independent investigation. American politics is rife with stories of redemption and people coming back, said Jay Jacobs, the New York State Democratic chairman, who had been one of Mr. Cuomo's closest allies, but called for his resignation last week. He's doing the best he can to preserve his legacy, the positive parts of his legacy. Jay Jacobs said that while it was clear that Andrew Cuomo had no immediate path to a return to elected office, he still had value as a potential resource to elected officials and leaders, perhaps in the future. But his current political outlook is bleak. Andrew Cuomo has alienated virtually every New York and national ally he once had. Even his longest, closest associates believed that he was out of options, with no path to political survival following the release of a searing report from the Attorney General's office. Early polling suggested that many Democrats wanted him to resign, and the state assembly still could press on with an impeachment. If he were impeached and convicted, he could be barred from holding state office again. And despite the sometimes regretful tone, Mr. Cuomo was far from fully conciliatory. he cast himself as a victim of a politically motivated controversy, suggesting that he was stepping aside to end a distraction for the state. The claim belied the fact that he had initially backed an independent investigation into his own conduct, perhaps hoping wrongly that he could control it in the way he has dictated so much else in Albany. Flanked by American and New York state flags, he minimized many of the allegations laid out against him, chalking them up to misunderstandings or suggesting they were the result of shifting mores around hugs or jokes. He directly apologized to a state trooper who had said he had improperly touched her, even as he maintained that while he may have been disrespectful and thoughtless, he had not intended to harass. A statement from the New York State Troopers Police Benevolent Association called his speech self-serving. "In my mind, I've never crossed the line with anyone, but I didn't realize the extent to which the line has been redrawn," the governor said. "There are generational and cultural shifts that I just didn't fully appreciate, and I should have. No excuses." Most of all, he sought to make common cause with those viewers who first knew him as Governor Mario M. Cuomo's older son. Mr. Cuomo reminded New Yorkers of their shared battles, in particular around the pandemic, and he emphasized his administration's achievements, reminding viewers of progressive accomplishments during his time in office, from enacting gun control measures to raising the minimum wage. In many ways, it was a textbook political speech studded with pivots to policy achievements, efforts to cast himself as a family man, and nods to once effective political slogans. Andrew Cuomo apologized to the women who have accused him of harassment, but also stressed his record on promoting equal rights and invoked his daughters, assuring them on camera that he would never intentionally disrespect women and describing his hopes for his three jewels. He made references to New York tough, the language he used as he sought to guide the state through the early days of the pandemic, and he spoke of his instinct to fight, even though in this instance he had to sublimate that instinct because he said a protracted impeachment battle would have hurt the state. "What matters is actually improving people's lives," Andrew Cuomo said after thanking members of his team, "and that's what you did. You made the state a better state for the generations that follow, and that is undeniable, inarguable, and true even in these ugly, crazy times." Mr. Cuomo was speaking to his staff, but he plainly believed those words about himself, reflecting recent conversations that he has had with people who have urged him to consider his future reputation. Andrew Cuomo, however, is a man who has always operated on his own terms, and for a week after the Attorney General's report dropped, he seemed to believe that he could fight the claims even as his closest aide quit, the highest-ranking Democrat in the country from President Biden on down, called for his resignation, and people he has long relied on for political advice saw no path forward for him. Still, the governor hunkered down, consulting with lawyers, his brother, his pollster, and a shrinking inner circle. But as it became clear that the state assembly intended to seek his impeachment, the situation grew less tenable. Under New York's rules, if a governor is impeached, the assembly, he or she must step aside even before a Senate trial has reached a verdict. Andrew Cuomo, accustomed to the trappings of power, would have been loath to sit through a trial as effectively a private citizen, people who know him say. Today was all about buying him 14 days to figure out the next phase of his life, as opposed to an impeachment vote which would have triggered his immediate removal from his actual home and the executive chamber, said State Senator Todd Kaminsky, a Nassau County Democrat. He wants to leave on his own terms, and he wants it to be as comfortable and least embarrassing as possible, as he bought himself 14 days to do that, he added. I don't think voters feel any differently about the acts, the nauseating conduct, and the Attorney General's report. Asked if Andrew Cuomo could run again, Mr. Kaminsky replied, I absolutely do not think so. Just before Andrew Cuomo spoke on Tuesday, 10th of August, his lawyer, Rita Glavin, made a lengthy presentation criticizing the news media and lacing into the details in the report. After she laid the groundwork, Andrew Cuomo came to his own defense. The political environment was to blame for his predicament, he claimed. Even on the brink of resignation, Andrew Cuomo seemed to believe that he could have won in the court of public opinion had he only had more time. This is about politics, and our political system today is too often driven by the extremes. Rashness has replaced reasonableness. Loudness has replaced soundness, he said. If I could communicate the facts through the frenzy, New Yorkers would understand. I believe that, he said. Representative Richie Torres, a Bronx Democrat, likened Andrew Cuomo's trajectory to a Greek tragedy. It's the most precipitous collapse in the history of gubernatorial politics, he said. And, as with all Greek tragedies, at the heart of it, it's all about hubris.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Dispossession, the great social housing swindle directed by Paul Sung. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him is Claudia Webb, who is a Labour Party councillor in the London Borough of Islington. Now, Dispossession is a documentary that explores the catastrophic failures by successive governments that have led to a chronic shortage of social housing in Britain. The film focuses on the neglect, demolition, and regeneration of council estates across the UK and investigates how the state works with the private sector to demolish council estates to build the land they stand on, making properties that are unaffordable to the majority of people.
They're going to regenerate it, which means total demolition. And when it very first started, it was a case of nothing will happen without your approval. Well, that was lie number one on day one, and it's never changed.
We've got councils of all kinds across London who are trying to demolish traditional council estates. They're actually destroying communities.
It was Mrs. Thatcher whose right-to-buy scheme was a vote winner for families like the Pattersons. She gave them the title deeds to their council house. They gave her tea in return.
Don't you think this is lovely?
The right to buy was probably the most popular policy ever introduced by Conservative government.
Housing is a fundamental human need, and it's one that the market just doesn't seem to be capable of providing.
We should be building every year about 240,000 to 250,000 homes, and we're nowhere near that.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
Essentially, we've had successive governments that simply haven't seen the role for social housing, and they've been cutting it.
It's not seen as being aspirational, and aspiration is the key word.
last 10, 20 years, housing stock that used to be here is down, it's gone.
Access to housing in Glasgow, to social housing, is nigh on impossible.
They are tearing apart our community, brick by brick, and we're not going to let them.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a very serious problem facing this country, and it was a very moving and deeply personal documentary for the director, I believe, as he grew up on a council estate. And especially in the wake of the Grenfell Tower tragedy, this film comes at a very important time. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I was very impressed by it. I thought the first time I saw this film, I was a little bit concerned about how compacted it was, the amount of information it crams into an hour and I think 26 minutes. The second time I saw it, I was impressed by the amount of information that it did get in, the amount of ground that it covers, the fact that it covers all these issues from so many different angles. I mean, you're getting the input of the politicians who have to make the policy decisions that cause estates to be built or to be knocked down. Mm-hmm. You're also getting the input from people on the ground, residents of the estates, who have a very different take on it. So I'm a big fan of this film.
So as you say, this documentary, it was very dense, packed with information, statistics, and usually these films are quite difficult to watch. So do you think the director was successful in conveying his message then?
Yes, because in part I think that it makes its points pictorially. I mean, it is very crisply shot, and it's one of the situations where I think if we're walking down a street anywhere, this is the kind of issue that hits you smack in the face. You know, we could go for a walk around the studios here and we would see 3, 4, 5 luxury flat developments, springing up everywhere, but we'd probably see more homeless people than we'd see social housing developments going up. And the film is very acutely attuned to what is actually happening at street level, and it shows you the disrepair that many estates have fallen into, and it contrasts that with the slightly sort of eerie gloom of these new developments going up that don't seem to be inhabited by anyone because no one's got the money to afford to move in there.
And Claudia, if I could turn to you now, as someone who works closely with this issue, is the social housing crisis in this country as bad as the documentary suggests it is?
Well, the documentary highlights quite well, actually, the state of play of council housing and council house in the UK, and in particular, actually, in London, and the sort of the dilemma that councils face as against the sort of the notion of community, the notion of identity, and the notion of neighbourhood, the concept of fairness. Right at the very heart of an urban inner city area, and what does a home mean? And it begins to explore what that means today, as against what it should have meant. And what we've got really in terms of what the documentary is portraying and what the film is portraying is this whole issue of council homes being sold off for profit, council land being sold off for profit, and exposing really a reality and dichotomy of huge waiting lists, homelessness, and yet council homes being sold in off for profit against that sort of waiting list, and then what happens to communities and what happens to neighbourhoods. It's a stark contrast, and the film has really brought home and brought out the realities of the dangers of making the wrong decisions.
Indeed, and this documentary, one of the key messages is that a home is a right and not a privilege.
We need to offer housing to people at lower rates than full market cost. And the way historically we've done that is we've built social housing, we've provided housing to people that the state has some direct investment in, on the premise that not everybody can afford to rent at full market cost, or indeed afford to purchase their own home.
The current government has slashed investment in social housing so much that the housing crisis can only get worse. The only solution is to invest in social housing again, both through local authorities to build council homes and through housing associations to build social homes, in the way that the post-war government invested, and they need to be homes that people can afford. Not homes that are called affordable, which are not.
if you build a council estate and people move in, those people pay rent to the local authority. After a few years, then the cost of building has paid for itself. Whereas if you have private rent, A, it's a lot more expensive, B, that money goes straight into landlords' pockets and doesn't get reinvested. It's a really good economic model, and it also points to the fact that housing should be a right for everybody.
In this documentary, we learn there's various misconceptions about social housing. Claudia, if I could ask you, why is there a need for social housing?
Well, social housing is really relevant in a local area where people, in a sense, can't afford to live in a home unless housing is provided that meets their ability to pay for that home. And in a sense, what we've got is a growing population and basic need. And a basic need is a roof over your head. And if councils are deprived from building homes, then in a sense, what you've got is demand outstripping supply. And really what the documentary highlighted by showing clips of Margaret Thatcher, it highlights Thatcherism and the policies of Thatcherism, which at the time
was the right to buy scheme.
Which was one, the issue about right to buy, but two, under Thatcherism, they stopped councils from building council homes. Councils used to be a machine for council homes. So within local authorities, you not only saw the production of homes, but you also saw the architects, the builders, the quantity surveyors, all of the professional skill sets located within a council. Those skill sets have long gone.
And thank you for that point and shedding light on the need for social housing. And Mike, if I can turn to you now, we learned from the film that there are various stigmatisms about social housing. What are they? What are some of these stigmatisms?
Well, one of the issues that the film addresses very well is the recent rise of TV shows like Benefit Street and things like that, where people who live on housing estates are, you know, it's these places are called sink estates, and you know, there's a certain stigma that goes with that. But there's a portrayal of people who live on estates as feckless and, you know, alcoholic, and you know, someone who exactly that's the kind of show. And these shows are very cheap to produce, like all reality TV, very cheap to produce, can get syndicated and make a TV channel or production company lots of money. What they actually give back to a society, a country, a community, very little. It sets, you know, to stigmatize the people who appear on these shows and people who live on council estates in general. And I think part of that is that because these shows are made by people from outside those communities looking in. And it's often, as the film suggests, people who actually live on council estates, they have a community, they have a life there, they know where they're going, they know, you know, where their house relates to other people, the people who live next door to them. And it's not a sink estate. It's they're not circling the plug hole. You know, they're getting by. These places are functional, but they're being depicted in such a way as to suggest that they're not, and that they need knocking down.
We're going to continue this discussion in the next part.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
In his first public speech following Labour's landslide victory in 1997's general election, Tony Blair stood on the Aylesbury estate in south-east London and vowed there would be no forgotten people in the Britain his party wanted to build. 20 years later, residents of the Aylesbury might wonder what happened to New Labour's bold vision of the future. Since 2001, campaigners have fought against Southwark Council's plans to regenerate the estate. The council argued that the Aylesbury needs to be demolished due to the high cost of essential repairs. Campaigners claim that the council allowed the estate to deteriorate in order to facilitate its demise and justify a £1.5 billion redevelopment project.
So we saw Tony Blair there. And Claudia, I have to ask you, why didn't Blair fulfil his promises?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is that when in 1997 Labour came into power in the aftermath of Thatcherism, in the aftermath of councils not being invested in to build council housing. And, you know, one could have wished and hoped that the new policy of Labour would have been to enable councils to build council homes again. A good council will build good quality homes, and with the resources and the investment, will invest in the stock that it has. But equally, if designs aren't right, and you know, designs for their time aren't always fit for the future, and you then need to think about how do you make that housing stock work? How do you make it livable and continue to be enjoyable? But equally, what's important is, and what I fundamentally believe in, is if you are going to regenerate an estate, then what you need to bring back is council housing. You regenerate the estate to create continued council homes, and that we shouldn't need to, as councils, go into business with the private sector and sell off the land and sell off the homes for profit. And that's what councils need investment, so they don't have to do that. Maybe that they weren't presented with was the investment that was necessary to rebuild council homes rather than engage in a partnership with the private sector.
So you're saying that the Labour Party, the new Labour back then, effectively inherited this crisis. But Mike, from the documentary I get the sense that the Conservative Party are much to blame, but do Labour share as much blame also?
Well, one of the strengths of the film is that it recognises that this is essentially a non-partisan issue. You know, everyone, whether you're of the right or of the left, needs a roof above your head. And I think it recognises, as much as, you know, Labour and the Conservatives like to play this fun game on Question Time of blaming one another for previous policies, there is a degree to which both parties are to blame, and this is why we're in the situation that we're in now. But yes, that right to buy scheme was, although a huge success at the time, has proven to take so many properties out of the public sphere and put them in private hands. But I think at the same time, the film says that, you know, when Tony Blair did come into power, not enough was done to counteract that policy. It was seen as such a sort of overwhelming success. What can you do? You know, well, you could build more houses, and I think that was one of the issues that leads to the situation that we're in right now, that we simply don't have enough houses for the people who need them.
And another, I want to talk about a different aspect of the documentary now. And one of the effects of the housing crisis seems to be the dismantling of the sense of community. I get this sense from the documentary that the film suggests that there were outside parties that were directly targeting and sort of dividing the community in order to conquer it. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is, in some ways, what the film is talking about is the direction of the entire nation over the past 50 years. I mean, we're told very early on that a lot of social housing was built close to factories, close to industries. And of course, once those industries closed down in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the last decade or so, where do the people who live on those estates go now? You know, how do they pay their rent? And if they can't pay their rents, does someone come in and take their property away from them? So that it's raising bigger questions than just questions around housing. It's about, you know, who, you know, how much responsibility do councils have for the people who live in within their remit.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll just have to pause there again just for now. I'll let you get back to that point, Claudia.
As the estate falls into decay, I believe it was a deliberate strategy of the local authority, because they saw the elephant castle at the time as a prime market for real estate.
I haven't got all the details on the Haygate, but my understanding is that some of the social rental properties will be built in another part of the borough. But again, it's around the fact that if we are going to take down a certain number of social rented properties, it's about making sure we're reproviding that, actually reproviding more for the same level of rent.
For the demolition of 9,000 plus council homes and their replacement with luxury apartments costing £600,000 and £700,000 as an entry price, was their answer to the problem. That's no answer to the 9,000, 10,000 tenants that were living in secure accommodation at the time that are now dispersed across London, and many dispersed outside of London.
People who benefit from the housing crisis are, of course, property developers. They want to have the densest housing possible. And the best way to make dense housing is to build luxury apartments and to make it look like, you know, you're building a tall tower block, not to house many families as they did in the 60s and 70s, but to give a really slick community lifestyle.
Now, before we went to that clip, we were just talking about the notion of dismantling of the community by outside parties. Claudia, did you agree with what Mike said?
Well, I mean, I have a different take on it because obviously we're in, my context is London, and I can see that in areas like Newark, in Nuneaton, for example, which had a coal industry, that if you create homes around a particular industry and then that industry disappears in terms of the mining industry, then you are left with homes and people without access to meaningful work. That's not the case in London. What you've got in London is a total land grab. It's a disgrace, really, in terms of a total land grab by big developers who are basically capitalising on the opportunity that is presented by the lack of inability of councils to build and invest in homes. The policy of not allowing councils to build homes, that is what's been problematic, because it's been over decades and not over a few years. What we have now in places like my own borough, where we have a good council that is building good quality homes, we bucked the trend and we sought to build council homes, and we sought to find ways to do that and ensure that we do not sell off council land. But where we have planning, where we give planning permissions to the developers where they've got their own private land, what unfortunately has been created historically over time is the notion of poor-dors. We have a policy of 50% of that must be affordable. Affordable meaning, you know, social rent properties. And what they do is they build that integral to the development, but they build it on the side or at the back, and that's where the creation of poor doors happens.
Of course,
it's
you're in Jeremy Corbyn's borough, and he's pledged to end the housing crisis. But I want to talk about this notion now in the film of social cleansing, which seems to be a contentious, controversial term, which means that low-income workers are being driven out of the capital, London, because of the soaring rents and the interests of corporations, of course, and real estate agents. What do we learn in the film about this? The
film's very good on gentrification and how neighbourhoods have changed rapidly over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, social housing is of less concern than attracting middle-class renters with lots of disposable income who can afford coffee and hummus and all the treats of living in the inner cities. But you know, there is a degree to which housing policy seems to have been skewed specifically, almost exclusively, towards that particular demographic. And of course, that, you know, drives out people who are originally living there. And you know, that's one of the many big issues that this film addressed.
Well, part of that was, you know, the whole huge banking crisis that happened. You know, what happened after the banking crisis was in London. Then, that, you know, London's property market was then used as the place where people invest. And so what you've got is overseas investors purchasing land and property, never ever living in those properties and creating a this and them scenarios and situations. What is a disgrace is when it's set against that. So you've already got that as a problem going on. Set against that is when councils have got land and homes in council control. What is a disgrace is councils then selling that off in some kind of partnership with the private sector.
It is such a complex issue.
It is.
And unfortunately, we're running out of time in this program. And just final 30 seconds to Mike. Would you recommend this documentary?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're now in a situation where the Evening Standard can run a front page about house prices going up as though that's some great triumph. To me, it looks more and more like a tragedy, and this film absolutely reflects that.
Well, thank you very much for your time and joining the show. And I'm afraid that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The protests for racial justice were wide-reaching. People from all walks of life in Britain, especially young people who took to the streets, were demanding racial justice. Not only concerned about anti-black racism in the United States, but also about deep and evident systemic racism in the United Kingdom. We now present you an article written by Richard Sedan. Richard Sedan is a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled, New UK Police Powers Aiming to Shut Down Black Lives Matter Protests Must Be Stopped. Police crime sentencing and courts bill is on its way to becoming law, making its passage through the UK Parliament before passing through the House of Lords. In the latest move by the government to clamp down on a number of issues, including what they claim is unlawful disruption. However, the move, which aims to give the police more power to carry out their duties, has actually produced more of the very thing which critics claim is the whole reason the bill came into being in the first place, which is, of course, the very legitimate and critical right to protest. In 2020, mass demonstrations took place around the country from both Black Lives Matter supporters, galvanized by the mass global movements for justice following the murder of George Floyd in the United States, and also environmental activists raising alarm over the growing climate emergency. The protests for racial justice were wide-reaching. People from all walks of life in Britain, especially young people who took to the streets, were demanding racial justice. Not only concerned about anti-black racism in the United States of America, but also about deep and evident systemic racism in the United Kingdom. Environmental protesters and demonstrations also swept across the country, with some in London causing disruption to public transport in order to get their message across and to get their voices heard. And getting the message to the forefront of public debate is precisely the point of the protests. While the British government has focused on the toppling of statues and of the inconvenience to those using London trains to get to work, to justify more police power, the reality is that should the police bill become law, it will likely be exploited to shut down very legitimate and lawful protests, with critics alarmed that the authorities will have the legal means to shut down and stifle any real criticism of the government at all. The problems of racial inequality, injustice, and of corruption and incompetence within the UK government, in many people's eyes, far outweigh and are of far greater concern than protesters stepping beyond the bounds of so-called legality. The right to protest in the United Kingdom is something purportedly sacred and is often talked about as being an essential cornerstone of Britain's so-called democracy. And yes, sometimes protests can get heated. But remember too that there are often serious questions about the conduct of the police, who many would argue themselves operate outside of the law, while at times being accused of breaking the law while operating with complete impunity. There has to be a balance, and listening to the concerns of legal experts and those with a keen eye on the importance of civil liberties, it isn't hard to see why there are serious concerns about the UK police having more powers. Many argue that the UK police need to correctly manage the existing powers which they already have and not be given more powers, which, as well as giving the police the power to keep people off the streets indefinitely, will also arguably impact and devastate the lives of Britain's traveller communities. Traveller communities have a way of life which is thousands of years old, and there are serious worries that the new police bill will be used in order to legally control their freedom of movement and to do the opposite of facilitating their way of life. Such communities are part of Britain's multicultural society and should have the same rights as everyone else and should not be treated as a nuisance to be pushed to the margins as the authorities see fit. The truth is that the British government was terrified by the collectivised message and power of protest movement last year, and in particular of the effectiveness of the Black Lives Matter movement, and the ability of such demonstrations to galvanise and inspire people to challenge power and the status quo. Also worth remembering is that a Metropolitan Police officer was charged with the murder of Sarah Everard. Some argue that there are serious problems within the police themselves, institutionally, which need rooting out, because they're given any more authority to adjudicate over the right of the public to mobilise, even if at times protests might become disruptive and hard for them to manage. When apartheid in South Africa was brought to an end, it was because mass global protests took place demanding it, and without such global protests, much needed change would have been jeopardised. Huge protests also just took place in London, demanding an end to apartheid in Palestine, with some even arguing that they were the biggest show of solidarity in the streets for the Palestinians which have ever taken place in Britain. This is something to be celebrated. But according to a new report, British media coverage of the recent Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip was biased against Palestinians and skewed public impressions. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring analysed the British media coverage of the conflict in a 44-page report entitled Media Reporting on Palestine 2021. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring stated that during the 11-day war, there were 62,400 online print articles and 7,997 television broadcasts in the United Kingdom reporting on the incidents. The report has revealed that while there were some examples of balanced coverage, the overall narrative was unbalanced due to the skewed language, misleading headlines, and problematic framing. Rizwana Hamid, director of the Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring and co-author of the report, told the Middle East Eye that the overwhelming amount of complaints about British media's biased coverage of events in Palestine aligned with the analysis and evidence of the monitoring organisation. The report found that half of the broadcast media clips in the United Kingdom between 7th and 10th of May referred to the situation in Sheikh Jarrah neighbourhood of the city of Al-Quds as an eviction or real estate dispute, which justifies the forced displacements of Palestinians, while the Israeli action were in contravention of international laws. Regarding Israeli police brutality against Palestinian protesters and worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the investigation highlighted numerous examples of media sources utilizing terminology such as clashes, conflict, scuffles and skirmishes to suggest equal blame. Rizwana Hamid said, as far as language is concerned, terms such as evictions mask the illegal forced removals and expulsion of Palestinians from their homes, adding that references to conflict and clashes try to equalize what is in effect a battle between David and Goliath. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring also cited several news reports speaking of an intifada, which it said played into fear-mongering and framing Palestinians as violent aggressors. Thus, more protests calling to kill the bill regarding the proposed police powers have also been taking place, and they will continue. It's abundantly clear that the British people do not want this bill to become law and value their right to protest and to speak truth to power as sacred. Rather than ploughing ahead with its current plans, for once this current government should listen to the demands of what seems to be the vast majority of the British people. In fact, people's demand to protest and assemble is a fundamental right of any free society and is the essence of free speech. The British government seeking the power to shut this down wherever they see fit is draconian and is the opposite of what people expect from a decent democracy.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Hussein's Mubahala, sacrificing his dearest ones to rise up on the path of God. August 30th, 2020. This is a short part of a Dars-e-Kharij-e Fiqh lecture delivered on the eve of Muharram on March 12th, 2002. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and may peace and greetings be upon our Master, the Prophet Muhammad, and his infallible household, and may God's curse be upon all their enemies. One of the important aspects of Muharram is the commemoration of a unique part of history. It is not unique only in terms of its tragedy and sorrow, which of course it is, but it is also unique in terms of its epic and the emergence of human greatness, the greatness of the people of truth. If you look at Imam Hussein's situation, you will see that his movement and uprising with such characteristics was unique. We have had many uprisings, but this uprising with these characteristics is unique. The situation was such that the domination of falsehood was increasing day by day with all of its cruelty and impudence. Enjoining good and forbidding evil was not possible at all.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance. September
27th, 2017.
The environment was so full of fear that those who used to enjoin good and forbid evil were trying to not become exposed to a situation where enjoining good and forbidding evil was necessary, even bold and audacious people. For example, Abdullah ibn al-Zubayr, who was a bold man, a very audacious man, even he was trying to avoid some face-to-face with the caliphate. The situation was this difficult. Someone like Abdullah ibn Ja'far, who was Amir al-Mu'mineen's nephew and the son-in-law and the husband of Lady Zainab, was trying to avoid even coming close to the caliphate, because nothing else could even be imagined. A person like Abdullah ibn Abbas became isolated from society. It was as if he had gone into seclusion and sat in a corner. People who were eloquent, fluent speakers, prominent figures, important personages of the Bani Hashim and Quraysh, and famous young people from the early years of Islam, each of whom had an honorable history, did not dare to take any noticeable action, let alone ordinary people.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
After 5 years of the closure imposed on Sana'a International Airport by Saudi Arabia, Yemen has held a protest inside the airport to renew their demands and call for its reopening. Protesters chanted slogans urging the international community to push Riyadh to remove its merciless blockade on Yemen.
The closure of Sana'a International Airport has caused a major humanitarian crisis, and it is a war crime. Yemenis are not trapped and considered hostages. The Ministry of Health statistics confirmed that more than 95,000 patients have died because they were unable to travel for treatment, and 480,000 patients urgently need to travel, and their fate is unknown amid the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. There are also 4 million expatriates who want to return, but the airport closure prevented them.
The repercussions of the Saudi violation of international covenant on civil and political rights and closing Sana'a International Airport are getting worse, especially to those with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure and liver, who hope to travel abroad for proper medical treatment, but unfortunately it seems impossible at least for a while.
5 years since the closure of Sana'a Airport, which is not a short period, it has caused an exacerbation of human suffering because the airport is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis. Before the war, 6,000 passengers, including 100 patients, used to leave every day from Sana'a Airport. More than 30 patients die every day due to the restrictions on the airport. There are more than 70,000 cancer patients and 20,000 kidney failure patients who need to travel for treatment amid the collapse of the healthcare system due to the fuel crisis caused by the Saudi detention of Yemeni oil ships.
At the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen besides its war, resulting in the closure of Sana'a International Airport to all flights and trapping millions of Yemenis, including patients, in a war zone. However, Sana'a Airport still receives the United Nations flights alone on a daily basis.
Thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, have died while waiting for a chance to travel through this airport. People here say the Saudi blockade goes against international law and its requirement that everyone should be free to leave any country, including their own. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The continuing fallout over Britain's Prince Andrew's friendship with the deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A lawsuit brought against a Duke by mother of three, Virginia Giuffre, who alleges she was trafficked to the prince by Epstein and his co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, when she was 17 and forced to sleep with him on three occasions. In a statement later, Giuffre said the powerful and rich are not exempt from being held responsible for their actions. I hope that other victims will see that it is possible not to live in silence and fear, but to reclaim one's life by speaking out and demanding justice. But the Queen's son denies any wrongdoing.
Things only started snowballing after that infamous interview. The humiliated royal was evicted from his private office in the building behind me at his mother's orders. Add to that the slew of companies and institutions that severed all ties with him.
66-year-old Epstein is said to have committed suicide in a U.S. jail in 2019, a month after he was arrested over sex trafficking charges. His partner in crime, Ghislaine Maxwell, has pleaded not guilty to those charges and is awaiting trial in November. It is yet to be seen how the Duke or the beleaguered British royal family will emerge from this new looming storm. Saeed Purizza, London.
Saudi Arabia issued sentences against 69 Palestinians and Jordanians residing in the kingdom, with some handed jail terms up to 22 years, while acquitting a number of detainees. Among the detainees is Hamas senior member Mohammed al-Khudri, who was sentenced to 15 years. His son was also given a 3-year jail term. Palestinians have slammed the court ruling, saying it follows the Israel